This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Jan Bartlett, 2 hours of current affairs. And you could be listening on the old analogue, 8:55 a.m. Or if you're on digital, it's 3CR. And there's the two ways if you do through your computer. You can be streaming for a week, which means that you can listen to any program on 3CR for a week, or the podcast, which you can have at your leisure, listen to your leisure. Go to 3cr.org.au for streaming and podcasting. Today we hear from Dr. Tim Anderson about the situation in Syria under the Islamic extremists for the ethnic and religious minorities. Professor Emeritus Damian Kingsbury, looking further than Donald Trump and his Nobel Peace Prize for the reasons for and the possible answers to the ongoing conflicts between Thailand and Cambodia. Dr. Alison Bronowski and her walk in the rain Sunday week ago, and how she's feeling about Albanese and his sitting on the fence over Palestine. Associate Professor Tilman Ruff will be talking about his lifelong quest to bring an end to nuclear weapons, the people he's met along the way, and the work they have been doing. Peace activist Kathy Kelly with some thoughts about Palestine and the future. And part two of the interview with Dr. Mark Diesendorf, looking at prospects for a sustainable energy future in Australia and the world. No Kevin today with his week that was, so straight on to Dr. Tim Anderson. Since the ousting of Bashar al-Assad in December 2024, the Islamist rulers have waged war against the religious and ethnic minorities in Syria. But who are the religious and ethnic minorities in Syria? What was the situation prior to the Islamists coming into power? This was the first question I asked Dr. Tim Anderson. What is the history of these groups, these communities in Syria?
Well, historically, Syria has been a haven for minorities, and the system until recently, the system under the Assad government was to try and, under the banner of a secular system, which according to their way of talking about secularism is pluralism, really, including minorities like the Druze, like the Christians, like the Shia and Ismailis and others. That was how the system was set up, really. It was the only, until the Al-Qaeda takeover in December last year, Syria was the only really non-religious state in the region, basically. You know, Lebanon is divided on sectarian grounds. The Israelis, of course, have created some what they call a Jewish state, and Iran is religious. You know, Iraq has a Muslim slogan on its flag, but Syria was dedicated to what they call secularism, but what we would think of as pluralism, basically. And that's why the Druze and the Christians and so on still found a haven there. It was not a rejection of religion, but an inclusion of different religions. And they had, for example, a government-appointed religious figure, a Grand Mufti, until fairly recently, whose job was to make sure that all of the communities got on and celebrated their religions together, basically. And now that Al-Qaeda regime in Damascus has him on trial as they're trying to have some show trials of the former officials of the so-called regime.
So you're saying that the different minorities and ethnic groups lived together? They didn't live in separate parts of Syria?
No, not exactly, because there were some enclaves, basically. You know, a lot of the Alawi people lived on the coast, and a lot of the Druze people, but not all, lived in the south on a mountain, on the Sweda Mountain in the south. But there were, you know, there were Druze communities in Damascus, in parts of northern Syria, and there were Alawi people all throughout the country. So there's some level of, what do you say, creating enclaves, but it wasn't formally in that way.
Talk about Sweda. That's been on the news this year with massacres of the people there. How serious is that?
It's extremely serious, and like a lot of things in that part of the world, there's going to be a second round, it looks like, because the regime in Damascus, which is installed by NATO, let's not forget, it was the occupation armies of Turkey and the US, the two biggest NATO militaries, and the Israelis that weakened Syria to the point where the command of that army collapsed, allowed this HTS group to take over Damascus, basically. But there was a reluctance initially for the HTS regime to make incursions into Ceuta because Netanyahu in Israel was making these threatening noises about his role as a protector of the Druze, because when the Israelis occupied parts of South Syria, the Golan Heights, they annexed a part that had a lot of Druze people in it. So there have been a lot of Syrian Druze, they still identified as Syrian, in occupied Palestine, in fact, well, occupied Syria, in what the Israelis considered an annexed part of Israel in South Syria. So Netanyahu has been using this pretext of a protector to try and annex more parts of South Syria, because as we know, this idea of a greater Israel extends well into Lebanon, well into Syria, and across to the Euphrates River.
And then the Alawites, and they're not going too well either.
Well, there were some terrible massacres in March, and there was some resistance to the introduction of this HTS regime. You know, HTS is a successor to ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, the two main al-Qaeda groups in Syria. And there was a resistance, initial resistance, a day of resistance by some parts, former Syrian soldiers. And in response, just like the Israelis in Gaza, there was this huge reprisal against the civilian population. Thousands of people were killed, and more thousands took refuge in the Russian air base near Jablay on the coast there. But basically, the Jalani regime, which is now celebrated by most of the Western states, took these terrible reprisals against civilians. And that's continued against individuals in the Alawi community who are thought to have had some relationship with the army, because the Syrian army, which was very popular all the time I was visiting Syria, of course was responsible for fighting and killing members of ISIS and al-Nusra, who are the colleagues of the current regime there. So that's why there's this witch hunt going on against anyone who is of any religion, by the way, could be Sunni Muslims too, who were involved with the army before or with, to some extent, with the Assad government.
We hear about the Bedouin tribes people in Palestine, but they're also in Syria. Can you explain that?
Yes, well, they're Arab clans, basically. The attack on Ceuta, which we didn't yet talk about just a few weeks ago, was presented to the world and presented by the mendacious corporate media also as some sort of sectarian tribal clash between the Druze and the Bedouins. In fact, it was nothing of the sort. It was the regime, the Jalani regime, attacking Ceuta directly and killing many, many hundreds of civilians. And recently some video has emerged of the HTS officials actually executing healthcare workers in hospitals in Ceuta, just like the Israelis did in Gaza, basically. But what they'd done was that they'd got some mercenaries in the Bedouin communities to join in. They'd paid them to join into their attacks on Ceuta. And then they presented it as some sort of sectarian natural sort of conflict between groups within Syria. Essentially, Syria is disintegrating by this regime, which is, as I said, backed by all the Western regimes, and particularly the US, is disintegrating, and people are now thinking, what can we do to save ourselves and save our communities? So there is some rallying, but under fear of civilian reprisals. The Druze themselves were organized. They responded in an armed way against the HTS attack on Ceuta. Because Ceuta has historically been a very, if you like, semi-autonomous Druze community in the south of Syria. The Syrian army allowed Druze groups to effectively defend themselves and run their own affairs, basically just protecting the outside. Just as the Syrian army did with the Yarmouk camp in South Damascus, they let the Palestinian militias, which are now disarmed by the HTS regime, they let them organize security within their own communities. That's the way it happened under the government of Assad in Syria.
Are the Kurdish communities also under attack?
Yes, they are, but because they've been supported by the US military in the northeastern and part of Syria, they're not very big. They're not as big as in Turkey, but the US gave them, under the banner of something called the Syrian Democratic Forces, the US back in about 2015 changed the name of a Kurdish security groups, to democratic forces, to try and pretend that it was wider than just a Kurdish independence group. But in fact, that's what it was. And the US, of course, used it as part of their divide and rule in Syria. Now, they haven't been able to integrate them with the HTS regime, because the HTS regime is extremely sectarian. And so there's now been some links formed between, for example, the Alawi minorities and the Kurdish minorities, although the Kurdish minority are now left stranded in their Kurdish autonomous project, because the major Kurdish autonomy group in Turkey has now effectively surrendered and given up arms to the Turkish government there. So they're left posted in a way, but they're still supported to a degree by the US and to some extent by the autonomous state, Kurdish state in northern Iraq.
Well, enter Israel into the fray. Where are they fitting in?
Well, their main role, the role of the Israelis, has been to, from the Israeli point of view, they're trying to annex as much as they can of South Syria in a de facto way, because it was never, even the Golan Heights were never recognized internationally. Trump made some noises about recognizing it, but really the international community, or let's say the Security Council, had never recognized the incorporation of the Golan Heights. But now the Israelis have gone much further up to the outskirts of Damascus, and including the mountains, which are the water source in that part of the world, on the western flanks of Syria. They're still occupying South Syria. It's believed, by the way, by my friends, that they're going to try another invasion of Lebanon to try and destroy the resistance forces in Lebanon, which includes Hezbollah, Amal, and all of the Palestinian factions, which are all represented in Lebanon, and they were represented in Syria until they were repressed more recently. So it's believed the Israelis will use that their foothold in Syria to try and invade Lebanon from the eastern flank and try and destroy elements of the Lebanese resistance there. So it's a dire situation, really, and it's getting worse, basically. And it's believed there's going to be a second attack on Sweida, because the HTS regime has been evacuating civilians and Jordanians, by the way, to Jordan in the south, which is effectively occupied by the US military, or deeply in the US camp, basically. So it's a terrible mess there now, because precisely the US has allowed this to happen. And of course, the US allowed the Israelis to invade Syria and to occupy it, and the Golani regime, the HTS regime, allowed that to happen, allowed the Israelis to destroy the air defense and most of the heavy infrastructure of the Syrian army now. So they have control of airspace now. The Israelis can actually attack Iran, fly over Syria without any fear of any air defense shooting at them there. They really see Syria as part of the extension of a greater Israel. In the meantime, there are some conflicts with Erdogan, with Turkey in the north, because Erdogan has his own ambitions for influence in Syria. And the US is really, in the meantime, sitting back and allowing the Israelis to do this. And despite the contradictions between the Israelis and Erdogan. So it's a terrible situation. And really, as I said before, the Syrian state, which was formerly a haven for minorities, is being disintegrated. And there's a terrible, dire, catastrophic consequences for the minorities in Syria. They are still being picked off one by one in many parts of Syria. Every day I see reports of, could be a dozen reports of attacks on kidnapping of these people in these minority groups, including the kidnapping of girls, the trafficking, sex trafficking of women in Syria. That's rife now, but it doesn't really appear on the horizon of the Western colonial media.
Well, apart from Turkey, what's the rest of the NATO countries doing, if they help put Jalani in power?
Well, although they haven't formally recognised him, because he's still listed as his organisation is still listed as a terrorist group by the UN Security Council, that hasn't changed, despite the fact that the US has withdrawn its designations. You find officials from the German government, from the other European governments, coming out and treating Jalani as though he is the actual president, although no one elected him. There wasn't a revolution. There was no election. They're treating him as though he's the president. They're starting to do business. Perhaps more importantly, the Gulf monarchies, you know, the Saudis, the Qatar, the Emirates and so on, are starting to do business with the Jalani regime, because they're very happy with a sectarian al-Qaeda regime in Syria. They're not happy with it at home, by the way. This is one of the contradictions of what's going on. You won't find the US or the Saudis or the Emirates happy with HTS or ISIS operating in their countries, but they're happy with it operating in Syria, because it destroyed the independent state which was supporting the resistance Remember, although Syria did not engage directly with the in the Palestinian struggle, but they provided weapons to the Palestinian resistance and also to the resistance in Lebanon. And that's the victory that the US was looking for in getting rid of the Assad government in Damascus.
Would you say that all what's happened since December last year was predictable?
Not really. It's what they aimed for. What was surprising to many of us was that the collapse, the rapid collapse of the command of the Syrian army, because the Syrian army, although they were being starved by the siege, there was a lot of will. They'd fought for many years to prevent happening what happened, basically. But how that collapse happened really effectively by the enemies, in particularly Qatar and Turkey, buying out, corrupting a lot of the leadership of the Syrian army at that time. That seems to be how it's happened. They've got some of those corrupt former commanders of the army in Damascus and in parts, in rural parts of the coast, still collaborating with him and trying to eliminate what remained of the former state there, basically. So it was certainly what they'd aimed for, but I think everyone was quite surprised, perhaps also Jalani himself and HTS themselves, by how quickly the Syrian army collapsed. It was a very disciplined force. So if the commanders were saying, pull back and do not engage with this ongoing invasion of al-Qaeda forces, which they've been fighting for well over a decade. If the leaders said pull back, the army did that because they were disciplined. I saw them, for example, being very disciplined by collaborating with the Kurdish forces at times, depending on the circumstances, and with some elements of the Palestinian groups which had joined in with the HTS, with the al-Nusra occupation of Syria.
And what's happened to the foot soldiers of Assad's army?
Well, many of them were jailed by Jalani. Some of them were thought to have been engaged in direct killing of ISIS and al-Nusra terrorists. They were summarily executed. Many of them were killed. Russia helped evacuate many of the commanders, the loyal commanders, basically the ones who wanted to keep defending Syria, evacuated them to Russia. There's well over 1,000, maybe a couple of thousand in Russia now, but silent. They're not telling their story because that's really the condition of the type of political exile there. Some of them went to Iraq, some of them went to Iran, but many of them went to Russia. The ordinary soldiers who they haven't been found to be killing Nusra, HTS, ISIS terrorists, are allowed to live, basically. There's a certain amount of space for people who are involved in the Assad government who are still in Syria, but they're at risk if they can be. Some of them are still being targeted. There's still a steady flow of political refugees and particularly Alawi people to Lebanon, for example. They're leaving the country still because there's this terrible, terrible tension, terrible uncertainty, and that hangs over the Christian community and the Druze community now, because of course there was that suicide bombing on a church in Dwella in southeast Damascus, and so there's great uncertainty and fear amongst the Christian community there too, which has been traditionally about the same size as the Christian community in Lebanon. And then you've had this attack on Sweida, which is now they're talking about another attack, so there's great fear amongst the Druze community too there. So a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear still in Syria.
I'd imagine the economy has suffered greatly due to this, and the health system, the schooling system, universities, people living in fear.
That's right. They've tried to change elements of the schooling system, in particular to, it's a holiday period now, but they're trying to take out a lot of history, a lot of historical records to Syrian nationalist leaders and Queen Zenobia in the past who resisted the Romans, for example. All of those things that are not part of the, you know, the Western media will call it Sunni Islam, but really it's a very narrow Salafi Takfiri version of Sunni Islam, an extremist sect that comes out of the Persian Gulf, from the Saudis, from the Emiratis and so on, from Qatar, from the Muslim Brotherhood. They're trying to expunge the history of the national heroes, Bashar al-Attrash and Queen Zenobia and so on. So there's some changes going on at an educational level as yet to be seen what happens there, but it's a very difficult circumstance. Economically, there is some new investment coming, as I said, from the Emirates, from the Saudis, because they're happy to do business with a new business configuration under Muslim Brotherhood networks, basically, in Syria. So there's some investment going on there. Before that, yes, there was a slow, although Trump was talking about lifting of the sanctions they had previously. In other words, you know, they're lifting sanctions now that they have an ISIS commander in charge of the country, basically. But the benefits haven't flown through immediately. There's some new Turkish commerce with Syria, but I'm not sure to what extent people are benefiting, because a lot of people lost their work when there was this takeover in December last year. There are a lot of people in the public sector, for example, who are without work, so without salaries, even though the currency value itself has stabilized somewhat, even though there's some new investment coming from some of the Persian Gulf Arab monarchies. But I don't think the benefits have flown through yet. There are Turkish goods on the market there, but I think the economic uncertainty is still there too.
You spent a week in Iraq recently. What was the purpose of that?
Yes, there was a conference, another conference, actually it's the third such conference that this group called the Global Campaign for the Return to Palestine held, trying to link across the different Muslim sects, that is to say, between the Shia and the Sunni, for example, because most of the Palestinian resistance is Sunni Muslim. Hamas, for example, Islamic Jihad, Sunni Muslim, they've returned to the resistance fold. They have very good relationships with Iran and Iraq these days, but nevertheless, there are different sects within Islam. So in Karbala in Iraq, it's a famous historic place of pilgrimage for Shia Muslims, because the site of the death of Imam Hussein, a great inspiration to the Shia Muslims these days. So this group in Lebanon has been trying to, or based in Lebanon, has been trying to organize these regular meetings in Karbala to link with and support the Palestinian resistance in Palestine. So they have these conferences which people come from all around the world, from Africa, from Latin America, from Europe, from different parts to Karbala to organize ways to support the Palestinian liberation movements.
But how does talk become action?
Well, through the different groups, you know, for example, some of the groups in Asia and Europe are now dealing with the question of Israeli tourists, how they can mobilize to prevent Israeli tourists entering their country and spreading their Zionist ideology in the country and carrying out abuses of the local cultures and so on. So there are some common concerns against people who are already engaged in action to support the Palestinian struggle in many different countries. So we were sharing information and resources and some degree of contacts and organizational contacts.
A few comments on the situation in Palestine at the moment, not only Gaza but the West Bank.
One of the key problems is that the Israelis have been emboldened by the fact that they have now attacked virtually everywhere in the region, and no one has done anything against them. None of their sponsors have lifted a finger against them. Now some of their sponsors in Europe are talking about recognizing a state of Palestine, which irritates the Israelis, but it doesn't really do much to stop what they're doing. For example, they're very emboldened by the fact that they managed to get Trump to join in with their attack on Iran, even though that attack back in June, the 12-day war back in June, even though Trump's intervention at that time was really to try and have a pause for the Israelis to allow them to rearm, because they were running very low on stocks of missile defense weapons and so on when the Iranians retaliated and were pummeling them, basically. But they, nevertheless, Netanyahu and his regime saw that as a success, as a victory, that they'd managed to attack for the first time Iran directly instead of just assassinating and carrying out terrorism around the edges. And they got the US to join in. So they're very emboldened by that. And it seems likely they're going to, apart from planning to invade Lebanon and trying to finish off the resistance in Lebanon, they are planning to attack Iran again, possibly next month sometime. So the US, the Trump's attitude to the Israelis, his support for them, and also even though the Germans have withdrawn a little bit, apparently the Germans have placed some temporary hold on supply of weapons to the Israelis. Nevertheless, most of their European partners, and despite the fact that they're talking about recognizing a Palestinian state, they've done this before. They've talked about the old myth of a two-state solution, but it hasn't really had much substantial impact on the Israelis, because there hasn't been a blockade, there hasn't been an embargo, which the activists have been demanding, you know, to stop the arms flow, to stop commercial support for the Israeli regime, or what the UN rapporteur calls the genocide economy. There's no action by the Western regimes against that. So that's the problem. And so the Israelis are emboldened to keep hanging on to annexing Syria, to plan another invasion of Lebanon, to plan another attack on Iran, you know, to keep bombing the Yemenis and trying to destroy their transport systems, their ports and their airports and so on. So what the Iranians called a cancer in the region, you can see it unfolding now, really, that it's only the resistance in the region, that the Palestinian resistance and the resistance in the region, like from Iran, from Yemen, from Lebanon, from the Iraqi resistance, that's imposing any constraint on this Israeli regime. We don't see any real restraint being imposed on them by their Western sponsors.
Thanks, Tim. Better let your voice have a rest.
Thanks, Jen. Sorry about the croakiness.
And many thanks to Dr. Tim Anderson for persevering with his raspy voice.
The Victorian state government is planning repressive new laws to restrict protest, including bans on protective masks and lock-on devices, increased police search powers, restrictions on symbols of resistance such as flags, and creation of so-called safe zones around religious buildings, putting significant areas of the CBD off limits. We must say no to this attack on democracy. Protest is a fundamental human right. Join the fight to defend it at a mass rally hosted by Defend Dissent Coalition on Tuesday, 12th of August, 5:30 p.m. at Parliament House. Defend Dissent Coalition is a 3CR supporter.
Cambodia will nominate US President Donald Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize, its Deputy Prime Minister said, following his direct intervention in halting the Southeast Asian country's recent border conflict with Thailand. But I think we have to look beyond Mr. Trump for the answer to the recent flare-up in conflict between the two neighbours in Southeast Asia. And to do that, I spoke with Damien Kingsbury, former journalist and academic, retired from Deakin University at the end of 2020 when he was made Emeritus Professor in July 2021. Damien, the recent fighting between Thailand and Cambodia is just the latest in a long-standing disagreements between the two countries. How far back in history do we need to go for the reason or reasons or perhaps the blame for the continuing tensions which erupt into conflict?
Well, there's three elements to the conflict, the first of which goes back to colonial history, the French carving out a border with Thailand and not demarcating the border properly. So in 1907, the French and the then Thai government decided that there would be a watershed agreement, that is, that the border would follow a watershed to the Mekong. But that was always a bit ambiguous, and the two sides have disputed the extent of the borders since then, particularly during the Second World War. The International Court of Justice has made a ruling on the border twice, and it has determined that the temple complexes, the ancient temple complexes in the border region, are within Cambodian territory, but access to them is via Thailand. The Thai government, or the Thai military in particular, has never been particularly keen on accepting this ruling. So that's one level of the conflict. The other level is that the Thai military has used the conflict or tensions around the border to embarrass its own former political leader and former prime minister, who's now been deposed. That's the second part. And the third part is that there are illegal internet or phone scam operations operating in the border region, which are controlled by the Thai military, and they can fall on either side of the border. So access to these scam centres and control over them is also a point of dissent between the two countries.
Let's go back to number one, to do with the temples. Who's at fault?
Well, it's not really a case of who's at fault. It's more a case of where the border is understood to exist.
So this is France?
Well, yeah. I mean, colonial powers always have a lot to answer for in the final analysis. But there has been a dispute over where the Thai and Cambodia borders exist. And they have moved since 1907. So in particular during the Second World War, when what was then Indochina, French colonial Indochina, was occupied by Imperial Japan, the border was extended. Now, Thailand was, in the early part of the war, was an ally of Japan, so the border was actually shifted back into Cambodia, so parts of what are now Cambodia were actually demarcated as Thai territory. At the end of the war, the border was pushed back to something approximating its earlier position. So the borders are not fixed. These are, in a sense, arbitrary borders. They are lines drawn on maps which don't necessarily correspond to where people of particular national groups might live, or who historically has had control over those regions.
And there's no way within Cambodia for people to get access to the temples without going through Thailand.
The main temple, Preah Vihear, sits on an escarpment or a cliff face.
Right.
The view that it has is magnificent. So the view from Preah Vihear looks over Cambodia, and the temple itself technically sits within Cambodian territory, but the back of the escarpment flows back into Thai territory, into Thai country, and that's where the border dispute has blown up on a number of occasions. The question is whether there should be access allowed to the temple via the Thai-controlled territory, or whether some of the territory should be ceded to Cambodia, because it's not possible to get to it via the cliff face. Of course, this goes back to the ancient Khmer Empire of the 8th and 9th century, when this temple was built. Of course, the Khmer Empire extended well into what is now Thailand, so that wasn't an issue. But since the demarcation of the border along the watershed to the Mekong, it has made access much more difficult.
Is anyone working, or people's working, on how to resolve this issue between the two countries on this particular point?
Not really, no. Thailand has refused international mediation on the issue, and I think this reflects the assertiveness of the Thai military, which really does run policy around border issues. They don't want external interference because they know that if there is external involvement, there will be a determination made, as indeed there has been already twice by the International Court of Justice, which will ultimately find in favour of Cambodia, and they don't want to cede that point. So whilst Cambodia is happy to have international mediation on the issue, Thailand is not, and Thailand doesn't recognise the ICJ ruling, and it also doesn't recognise any further international involvement in this particular issue.
Well, number two involves the military. Does it also involve the two main families in Cambodia and Thailand?
Yeah, look, Thaksin Shinawat was Prime Minister of Thailand many years ago now. He essentially was the leader of a populist movement, a very wealthy man in his own right, a billionaire, but led a populist movement in Thailand, which was, if you like, counterposed to the elite control of the country, which corresponded to the king, the royal family, and the Thai military support for both the royal family and for the elite political and economic structures. So Thaksin came up and was elected as Prime Minister, and the military said, well, we're losing control of the situation. So they staged a coup and got rid of him. But his party has transformed over the years, and it's under a number of different guises and continues to receive popular support. It's also received popular support initially under the leadership of his sister, and then more recently that of his daughter. And the Thai military basically sees this as Thaksin by any other means. So they have pushed both Thaksin's sister out of power in a coup, and more recently have pushed out his daughter in a judicial process that was allegedly around ethics, which is unusual in a place like Thailand, because his daughter had conversations with Cambodia's former Prime Minister, Hun Sen, about the border issue in seeking to resolve it. And in the conversation she had, she referred to him as uncle, and she said that the Thai military had behaved very badly. Thai military said that that was a breach of ethics and loyalty to their own country, and she has since been judicially deposed.
Well, this is just one of many coups, surely, in Thailand.
Yes, Thailand has a very long history of coups, going back to the late 1930s, and it has had a history of military involvement in government, indeed, up until the 1950s and 60s, and then into the 70s, Thailand had military governments, and it has had on many occasions the military taking over and running the place, including up to this century, up until the last 10 or 15 years. We have the Thai military that sees itself as having an inbuilt role in Thai politics. It sees its role as preserving the status quo, as it determines the status quo. The status quo is built, as I mentioned, around the royal family and the position of the king. And around that is built an economic elite. And the Thai military is deeply embedded with this economic elite itself. It has many of its own business interests, which are quite substantial and which reward its senior officers. So it sees its role as preserving this version of the status quo against what appears to be a push by a more populist party, arguably a more left-wing party, but certainly a more populist party, which is based in the regions, essentially amongst the rural population.
Well, into the scene comes the Hun Sen family.
Yes. So we have Hun Sen, who has stepped down as Prime Minister of Cambodia, and his son, Hun Manet, is now Prime Minister. But Hun Sen is still the power behind the throne. He's the Speaker of the Cambodian Parliament, but he really continues to wield a great deal of influence. So if he has a conversation with the Prime Minister of Thailand, that is understood to be effectively as important as having a conversation between two Prime Ministers, even though Hun Sen is no longer Prime Minister of Cambodia. So this conversation that was had with Hun Sen was recorded. It was leaked, and the recording was leaked, and in the recording it does have the now ousted Prime Minister of Thailand referring to Hun Sen as uncle. Now, that reflects the Thaksin Shinawatra's close relationship with Hun Sen. Thaksin himself actually lived in Cambodia for some time. He was given protection there. Cambodia refused to extradite him to Thailand. And when Thaksin eventually went back to Thailand a couple of years ago, went back to jail very briefly, the king said, okay, look, you know, we'll pardon you, let you out. Hun Sen came to visit him immediately on his release from prison. So the relationship between Thaksin and Hun Sen is quite close. Having said that, Thaksin recognises that the Thai military does have the whip hand in this issue, and he has decided that perhaps his friendship with Hun Sen is not worth angering the Thai military any further. So he has actually now supported the Thai military in this more recent conflict over the border region.
Apart from all this, is there another elephant in the room or not?
There is, believed to be, and I don't have hard evidence of this, but I have reports of this from people I know who know the area quite well and whose judgment I trust. And they say that there's a number of scam telephone operation centres in the border region. That stands to reason, because we know they exist on the Thai border with Myanmar, and that's been well documented. So the fact that they would also exist on the Cambodian border wouldn't be at all surprising. These are basically operations which are great money-making centres. They're staffed by people from Cambodia, primarily, who are effectively slaves and kept as prisoners by the Thai military to operate these centres. And this is a great money-making scam for the Thai military. But the problem is, of course, it operates on the border, which is under dispute, and the Thai military is keen to be able to ensure these operations continue without having to be susceptible to Cambodian control or interference.
Is it an intractable dispute? Because you've got a much larger country in Thailand, you've got a much poorer, smaller country, Cambodia?
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. I think that the fact that Thailand is refusing to have international mediation is probably the biggest issue here. And look, neither side really wants to have a war. They both know that the costs of war exceed the benefits. But there is, from time to time, a dust-up around the border region about who controls what, about access to these call centres, about national pride, which runs very strong in both countries, and, of course, in the case of Thailand in particular, about ensuring that the issue can be used to embarrass the Thaksin family when it's in power to show that it doesn't really have control of what's going on in its regional relations.
Are there any influences from outside?
The United States and China both have an interest in the area. China has been fairly hands-off to date, but Cambodia is effectively a Chinese client state. The United States has also stepped in this recent round of fighting and said to both countries, look, you know, you need to settle this down, otherwise we're going to slap you both with tariffs. That corresponded to an end in the fighting, but I'm not sure that it actually was the cause of the end of the fighting, even though Donald Trump is claiming it to be a victory of his. I think that both sides basically, this got out of hand. Thailand wanted to create an embarrassment for the Thaksin family. They did that once the Thaksin's daughter was removed from office. This continued on. So the Thai military said, we've achieved our objective with this. We don't actually want this to continue any further. There's no benefit in it. So I think they were quite happy to stop the fighting. And Cambodia, militarily, even though it's been recently rearmed by China, doesn't have the capacity to take on a much bigger and much more powerful country such as Thailand.
Just finally, Damien, while the parties in these conflicts are playing war games with each other, it's the populations in the border areas who are paying the price.
Yes, and as always in wars, it's there are generals which will pursue particular goals, but it's civilians who ultimately pay the greatest price. It's always a disproportionate death toll between military people and civilians, and certainly that was the case in relation to this recent blow-up between Thailand and Cambodia. We don't know precisely how many people have been killed, but it's about 40 or 50 on each side. And that's not obviously on the scale of somewhere like Gaza at the moment, but it is a problem for the people whose lives are there. You know, civilian infrastructure was targeted, the lives have been disrupted, hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced. And, of course, it always does have the scope for getting out of control. And that's a problem with these sorts of conflicts, is if they can be contained, all well and good, that's a great thing. But sometimes they're not contained, and despite the best efforts of governments, the shooting continues and it ultimately escalates into a full-blown war. And we have seen in the past the consequences of that in Southeast Asia, where tens and indeed hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives.
Well, as you said, there's three issues and none of these have been resolved. So there is a possibility that this conflict will continue into the future.
Yeah, it's probable that there will be continual flare-ups. But I think whilst the issue is one of external control about interests such as control of scam centres, using the issue to embarrass certain political figures in either country and so on, that it will be contained. Neither country wants to see this get out of control. Having said that, there is always the possibility that events could escape the control of the people who are basically deciding the fates of the people who live in the border, and it could blow up into a full-scale war between the two countries, or indeed involving other countries.
Thank you, Damien.
Thank you, Jan.
And I've been speaking with Emeritus Professor Damien Kingsbury.
Capitalism's inherent barbarism is on full display, from the genocide in Gaza and the rise of the far right, to growing militarism and the climate crisis.
We need to radically change the way society is organised.
Join us for the upcoming Eco-Socialism 2025 conference, Eco-Socialism, Not Barbarism,
held on September 5th to the 7th at the Balam Place in Brunswick. We will be bringing together activists from across the Indo-Pacific, sharing experiences to resist capitalism's drive to barbarism and build the mass movements that we need. Anyone who wants to be part of the discussion on how we can build a left-wing alternative is welcome to attend. Featuring international guests from the United States, Pakistan, India, Malaysia, and Brazil, along with local campaigners. Organised by Green Left and Socialist Alliance. Find out more by going to ecosocialism.org.au. Green Left is a 3CR supporter.
Last Friday morning, I spoke with Dr. Alison Bronowski, AM, former Australian diplomat and member of Australians for War Powers Reform. And I began by asking her about her walk in the rain last Sunday week with a few friends in Sydney.
One or two friends, yeah. It depended who was counting. It was amazing. It was terrific. Somewhere at the end of it was my granddaughter, and somewhere in the middle of it was my daughter, and we couldn't see them at all. It was young and old and babies in strollers and all sorts of people from every possible background in Australia. It was just, the atmosphere was just so happy, not happy about what's going on, of course, but pleasant, friendly, and people chatting to total strangers and absolutely none of the problems that the Premier and the Police Commissioner thought would occur. None.
Well, there never has been, has there?
No. Every Sunday, the pro-Palestinian demonstrators that have met all over different parts of Sydney for now, ever since October 23, it's the same thing. I mean, they too, although they make a lot of noise, nobody aggro, nobody is violent, and there's never any problem of any kind. Even the police who are there, sort of relaxed and just chatting with people. For people like the Premier of New South Wales to be so opposed to this thing, have to go to court with one of the organisers of the march to oppose it and lose that action, is really a commentary on how he doesn't get it. He doesn't get it at all.
Well, he gets it, but he gets it the wrong way.
He certainly does. So, of course, does the Murdoch media and all the people who wrote this up around the world as if it was a terrible, violent gathering of renegades and shocking people. And it was absolutely incorrect. They should have been here and looked.
What was it like when you got to the end and the police said, you're not going any further, you can go back? And you've already walked how far in the pouring rain?
We had walked from Wynyard Station, like in the middle of the CBD, up York Street to the bridge with a whole lot of other people. And then we walked up along the bridge to about the midpoint. And I can remember it was the midpoint because I looked up and could see the Aboriginal flag right up there on the top. And a whole lot of bridge climb people looking down, having a good view. At that point, a helicopter coming over, making announcements to the crowd that nobody could hear properly, stuff through a megaphone. And then people started getting messages on their phones. Everybody did. And it said that we had to go back because they were worried about a crowd crush at the northern end of the bridge, which in fact didn't happen and wouldn't have happened if they'd let half the march go through to Milsons Point and half go on to North Sydney. But they didn't want to do that, did they? And the speculation is that the reason they didn't want to is that they knew that the objective of the march was to end up at outside the US Consulate General.
So, in a sense, if there had been a crush or incidents, it would have been the doings of the police and the way that they were carrying on.
I think so. It was difficult for me to say because I was in the middle of the crowd and couldn't see either the back of it nor the front of it. And there had been police horses in front of it, which I didn't see, but they were there at the front in the park where they, in Lang Park, where the crowd started off from. And all of that was quite unnecessary. It was a show of force and just didn't need to happen. And there were no accidents, no incidents, and no crowd crush.
And I believe the images of this massive demonstration went straight to Gaza?
Well, it's gone round the world. I do hope it has reached Gaza and given people a certain amount of moral courage. But you know, of course, that today is the day on which Netanyahu is making this momentous decision, telling the defence force, the IDF, to go in and clear out the whole lot, clear out everything in Gaza. And the IDF doesn't like it. The world community doesn't like it. And Netanyahu has to do it because that's his objective. He's going to do this and he's going to stay in power. And if he doesn't stay in power, he'll be in jail because he will be able to be prosecuted by the courts. And today, in spite of our efforts on Sunday to raise global awareness of this, apparently in America, very few people, until very recently, even understood what was going on, let alone cared. And they haven't been told sufficiently by their own media any more than people in Israel have been. Apparently, media in Israel have been very silent on an awful lot of things. And we only learn this from courageous journalists like Gideon Levy in Tel Aviv, who tells people, but apparently a lot of people don't read him. And Haaretz has done a pretty good job, but it's very alarming. And when this kind of thing, particularly including the risk of a nuclear attack on Iran or an attack on nuclear facilities in Iran, when this kind of thing is even contemplated and people don't understand what's going on, it really is a very alarming situation.
I think you'd have to extend that to Australian audiences too, of if people watch Sky News, Channel 7, Channel 9, Channel 10, whatever they are, and they don't go on social media, they don't watch the ABC now, which is actually behaving itself a little bit better, they are ignorant, because I've spoken to people who are not politically active and they really don't know what I'm talking about when I talk about Gaza.
I know, and unfortunately, this is the way it always is. It took years for people to wake up to what was going on in Vietnam. It took years for people, the people you're referring to realise what the issue was in Iraq. People who get their news from all the above, whom you mentioned, if they take any interest at all, it alarms me that they can vote, quite frankly. I think they should be asked to pass a test about public awareness of various important issues. And this is another matter, not that a vote would make any difference, because our government, and you say it's an Australian issue, yes it is, our government doesn't take foreign and defence policies to an election and say to people, look, this is what we intend to do in this way and that, and on this issue and that. Instead, they talk about housing and health and education and blah, and not that these things are not important, but they don't give people the information they need to make an informed vote. They withhold it themselves.
I know very few people now listen or watch the ABC, but I feel as though someone's put a bomb under them in the last couple of weeks regarding Israel and Palestine.
Something at last has begun to change at the ABC, but it's not enough.
No.
Actually, this morning, Sarah, a very good journalist, an Israeli journalist that she was talking to, and he had a very positive approach. But that was rare. I mean, quite frankly, she gets some people on who are to the right of the soup spoon, really. And whether this is the ABC trying to demonstrate balance or whether they have rules of their own about things that are not allowed to be said, I mean, the BBC won't allow its presenters to use the word genocide or apartheid in relation to what's going on. And I wouldn't be surprised if similar rules apply at the ABC. They're terribly cautious, and their approach to these issues seems to me to be very risk averse, even now.
Absolutely. Now, there is also an open letter which you and your husband Richard have signed to Mr. Anthony Albanese, MP. What's in that letter?
That letter was signed by 17 former diplomats, mostly former ambassadors, and we decided that it was an urgent matter for us to bring our concerns to the attention of the Prime Minister. And basically what we were saying was that Australia has to stand up and be counted, along with 147 other member states of the UN, in opposing Israel's actions in Gaza and the United States' support for them, and saying that Australia will not continue to export weapons or weapons parts to Israel, that Australia will follow the rulings of the international courts and not make just little gestures about not allowing one or two war criminals into Australia, but actually imposing the kinds of restraints on Israel that we did on South Africa years ago, much more quickly and much more easily than we're doing it this time, and other such concerns. And we also point out that this is a matter of urgency, because the way things are going, there won't be anything left in Gaza unless this process is stopped.
Do you think Anthony will make that decision before the meeting of the General Assembly next month?
He and Penny Wong have been creeping inch by little inch towards something like that. Other countries, many other countries, but some Western countries, like, for instance, Ireland and Spain, have already moved in that direction and done what the international courts required. But we are holding back, as we always do, as allied countries usually do, to wait to see what their major allies do. Now, Britain and Canada have made peculiar statements setting down conditions for recognition of Palestine, rather than saying, yes, a Palestinian state has to be recognized, because how can you have a two-state solution when you've only got one state? I mean, it seems to me to be perfectly obvious that that's what Australia should be doing. But Britain and Canada have imposed a strange situation on this, saying, unless the hostages are released to Israel, in which case that doesn't have to happen, it seems. Very strange. Either there's a principle here about a Palestinian state, or there isn't. And the point is that you can't have a two-state solution or any future for Gaza and the West Bank unless that state exists. Now, Peter Rogers, one of our colleagues who used to be ambassador in Tel Aviv, has been interviewed on this subject several times since this happened. He regards this as less of an urgent thing than I do. But I think it's urgent that Australia should get in ahead of the crowd before the General Assembly meeting in September in New York. And for once, look as if we have an idea of our own, not wait until we're told what our allies are going to do, because our allies are floundering around, and our biggest ally, the United States, is not doing anything except backing Israel and talking in mealy-mouthed terms about aid. We have to show that Australia has some principles. And that, coming back to the march, is what everybody there was trying to show, I think.
All right. Well, we just have to keep pushing along with the government too, to make sure that they do realise that there's a huge groundswell of people in Australia who are demanding the government do what they should be doing, what they should have been doing a long time ago.
Exactly so. And, of course, the Victorian ALP had its meeting at the weekend, and they said the same sorts of thing. They made a resolution saying the same sort of thing as you've just said. And, of course, that is not binding upon the federal ALP. But when you say they must be hearing it, they hear that. They hear our statement. They hear what the people on the bridge have said. They can't pretend not to listen. They have crept inch by tiny inch towards doing something, mainly talking about aid, but that you can't have a two-state solution until there are two states, and they've got to get behind that.
Thank you once again, Alison.
It's a pleasure, Jan. Nice to talk to you.
And I've been speaking with Dr. Alison Bronowski, AM, a former Australian diplomat and a member of Australians for War Powers Reform. And as I said at the beginning, I spoke with Alison last Friday, and just yesterday, Mr. Albanese has decided to get off the fence regarding Palestine, but I think he's got a fair way to go before he puts his feet on the ground properly.
The war on Palestine has not stopped. Palestinians need self-determination. Gaza must be free of Israeli occupation forces, have unconditional access to aid and reconstruction. 17 years of Israeli siege must end.
The West Bank needs the violence and attacks by the Israeli army and settlers to stop, and an end to the occupation and apartheid.
Your support to end the war on Gaza to bring peace, justice and freedom to all of Palestine is needed more than ever.
Join the nationwide rally on Sunday, the 24th of August, 12 noon, outside the State Library Victoria on Swanson Street.
With Netanyahu and Trump threatening to ethnically cleanse Gaza and annex the West Bank, we all need to stand up and say no.
Nationwide rally, Sunday, 24th of August, midday at the State Library.
With your support, Palestine will be free, from the river to the sea.
Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
Last week, the US dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, resulting in an estimated 100,000 to 200,000 deaths in the two cities, where tens of thousands are dying from exposure from radiation to this day, and survivors continue to suffer. One Australian who has dedicated a large part of his life to the eradication of these weapons, now in the hands of an increasing number of countries, is Associate Professor Tilman Ruff. And I'd like to share with you the work that Tilman has done in seeking to eradicate these weapons. He's served as co-president of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, IPPNW, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. Was founding international and Australian chair of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017, and is a past president of the Medical Association for the Prevention of War. He is one of two civil society advisors to the International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, led the IPPW delegation to New York through the negotiations of the historic UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which was adopted on the 7th of July 2017 and which entered into legal force on January the 22nd, 2021. And there are a number of awards for Tilman, both national and international, for his work. When I spoke with Tilman late last week, I pointed out that it's been a lifelong goal of his to eradicate what he believes is the most acute existential threat to public health that we all face, and asked him if he can remember when he first learnt about the release of these bombs in Japan in 1945.
I sort of learnt about them gradually, I think, as a child. My parents didn't talk about nuclear weapons very much. They had been displaced by war and, you know, lost many family members and were deeply traumatized and displaced and interned for 7 years. So the experience of the Second World War was very bitter and recent and pervasive for them. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I didn't really understand what was happening, but there was obviously something very big happening that got everybody very worried. I think that's when I first got a sense that, hey, these things have really changed the world and are going to be with us until we get rid of them.
What was your first activism once you realised the enormity of it all?
Around nuclear weapons, was probably joining a Frankston Melbourne march on the Hiroshima anniversary in 1970, which is a wee while ago now. Yeah, that was probably the first sort of major thing I did. I had, prior to that or around that time too, become involved in peripherally, but very supportive of the movement to stop Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War. And I guess those huge moratoriums, you know, with 100,000 people on the streets of Melbourne and leaving school to join those was sort of my first real taste of, you know, people acting together with persistence and consistency on a big issue could change national policy. Yeah, and I learned some of that too through Amnesty International. We set up, I think, what was then the world's first secondary student group of Amnesty back in 1970. And I had the experience of the adopted young Greek prisoner, then a military regime in Greece, pretty brutal. He'd been imprisoned for writing a slogan on a wall, nothing more. Poor farming family, we were able to provide support for them, for which they were very grateful. And when he was released, I will never forget the handwritten letter from his father, probably written by a neighbour. I think his dad might have been illiterate, that, you know, thanking them enormously for the help and support we provided and their joy at his release. So the sense that you could make a difference to somebody's life on the other side of the world because of some vague notion of universal human rights was pretty empowering too.
But you wouldn't have imagined that at that time of your life that you would be spending a great deal of the rest of your life fighting against nuclear weapons?
No, I really had no idea at that stage.
How did it change then?
Well, I guess it changed for a couple of reasons in the 80s. And the late 70s, I sort of got involved as a medical student in the issues around uranium mining in Australia when the Ranger Uranium Inquiry was going on, this, you know, really big public process sort of considering if and how Australia should get involved in commercial export of uranium. Of course, we'd already been involved in producing radium and uranium for most of the 20th century and probably have the dubious distinction of being the only country on Earth that mined uranium that was then turned into a nuclear weapon by the British that was then detonated on our own soil in the British nuclear tests in Australia. So I got involved in that debate and that sort of introduced me to nuclear issues. But I think being alive, you know, in the 80s and late 70s, it was pretty hard not to have a, you know, a very visceral fear and consciousness every day that, you know, these things could be used and end things very abruptly for all of us. And nothing else we might do or care for or work for, you know, might matter, or anything that humans have built and achieved over all the millennia might matter, you know, in an afternoon. So that sense was, you know, really hard to avoid in those days. And we bought a share in a farm a couple of hours outside Melbourne, thinking that, you know, if the worst happened, we needed somewhere to escape to, you know, a clearly forlorn hope from what I've learned since. And then having our daughter in the 1982 and son a few years later, you know, that very deep sense of parental responsibility of not just, you know, for their immediate safety and well-being and nutrition and, you know, being safe on the roads and all those things you worry about as a parent, you know, also extended to the kind of world that they would grow up in, and trying to make that safer for them and their children and future generations, I felt as a very profound parenting responsibility, and I now feel as a very profound grandparenting responsibility. And then I got involved in the Medical Association for Prevention of War soon after it kicked off in Melbourne in about 1980. Very quickly saw, and then through International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War a few years later, the International Federation of which MAPW is the Australian affiliate, how much sort of health evidence-based advocacy, really engaging with decision makers and politicians, and the kind of authority and access that speaking to the evidence of which, you know, health professionals are the expert custodians, that's our kind of ethical professional responsibility to speak to, that if a nuclear war happened, if even a single nuclear weapon were detonated on a city, it would be an unmitigated catastrophe for which no effective health and emergency response was possible, and that the risks were profound, and where there's no cure, prevention's the only option, and that requires the elimination of the weapons. I mean, spelling that out in detail, you know, made a big difference, and I saw very quickly how much influence that had, the medical and scientific evidence, and putting it effectively to Reagan and Gorbachev was really what made them seriously consider and discuss eliminating their nuclear arsenals entirely, and made a major contribution to ending the Cold War and the arms control, the reduction in nuclear weapons that happened around that time. So I saw very quickly that doing this work could really make a difference, probably bigger than anything else I could possibly be doing in medicine, and working with really inspiring and inspired people from right around the world. And then I got a nasty cancer that sort of you wouldn't wish on anyone, but coming through that really gives you a very powerfully deepened sense of the fragility and preciousness of every day, and wanting to spend your time on what really matters, and, you know, and not the fluff. So that sort of really helped me focus. So over those years, that combination of factors really made me feel that, yeah, this is the work that really I need to be doing for as long as I can, as well as I can.
Who were your main mentors during those years?
There were a number of people, and of course you always mention people at risk of leaving out some important ones, but I wasn't really sure where I wanted to go with sort of study and life path, and after a couple of years of science at Monash, you know, thought better to get out and see a bit of the world and taste the working life rather than, you know, to sort of, I guess, find my feet, but also just, you know, head out and explore the world a bit. So I went to the Philippines and Japan and Europe and met some extraordinary people, and particularly a Jesuit priest called Sam Wiley in the Philippines, American guy who'd lived there since the Second World War, who was extraordinarily effective at getting people out of jail and out of the country. And going around visiting prisons and military camps with Sam was pretty formative experience. A Christian theologian in Japan called Toshikazu Takao, an uncle of one of my dearest friends, became a really important mentor. He'd been involved in all sorts of peace and social justice struggles in Japan, had lost an academic job as a result, and a very courageous man. In Australia, Herb Feith, who was professor of politics at Monash, a world-renowned Indonesian expert, and Dick Wooten, who sort of led the social justice, human rights and international work for the Uniting Church, were really powerful influences on me. And then in the physicians movement, I think so many people were inspired by Helen Caldicott, Australian paediatrician, who really elevated with extraordinary eloquence and clarity that this was really the ultimate epidemic, potentially, if nuclear weapons were used, that use had to be prevented, that it was urgent to eliminate these weapons, and that this was a health responsibility. And Bernard Lown, the cardiologist who invented the defibrillator, which has saved many lives from sudden cardiac death, who founded International Physicians Group, was an important mentor. Ian Maddox in Adelaide, who was the founding head of the medical school in Papua New Guinea, was a big supporter and influence, and really got me, pushed me and encouraged me, mentored me in getting involved in the international politics of and running of a medical organisation. John Pastore, a fantastic Boston-based cardiologist, and I couldn't not mention a guy called Manuel Velasco Suarez, who was really the founder of neurosurgery in Mexico and Latin America more broadly. His name is now is on the, you know, the shield of the largest neuroscience institute in Latin America, who'd been the governor of Chiapas, the southern province, an extraordinarily wonderful man, and who always saw politics as an extension of his health work, was an extraordinarily important and wonderful mentor and teacher. So I've really been blessed with lots of people who've left big shoes to follow.
When was your first visit to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and who did you go with?
I can't actually specifically remember the first time I went now. I've probably been to Hiroshima maybe 15 or 20 times over the decades. It's always an incredibly moving and humbling experience, particularly the privilege of meeting Hibakusha, the survivors of that terrible tragedy, who really endured what, you know, what no human or any living thing should ever have to endure, and who came through that with almost universally the most extraordinary deep humanity and courage, you know, to retell and thereby relive every time they tell, you know, that extraordinarily painful, distressing story of what happened to them and their families and friends and the world that they knew, that was just consumed in a radioactive incineration that, you know, killed 70,000 people on that day and 140,000 by the end of that year, and has killed tens of thousands since. But their lack of anger, their lack of desire for vengeance and retribution, they're just their burning hope that what they suffered should be heeded and acted on, that these weapons must be eliminated so that no one ever again anywhere needs to suffer what they did. That courage and humanity is an extraordinary privilege to listen to and to reflect on, especially at this 80th anniversary. They're not going to be around with us for much longer. We really need to honour their suffering. The best way to do that is to work to get rid of these weapons.
Is the way that they cope with that part of the Japanese culture, or is it more than that?
I think it's much more than that. Of course, it's culturally influenced, as everything we do is, but, you know, there's angry. There's people who have been very angry. Setsuko Thurlow, who's another terrific mentor, Hibakusha survivor who co-accepted the Nobel Peace Prize for ICANN. I mean, she's, you know, she tells us she was angry. But it turned into, you know, it was a good kind of anger. It was not revenge, spiteful kind of anger. It was the justice that they seek is the core element of it, is that this not happen again, that Nagasaki forever be the last nuclear bombing in war on this planet. There's also, you know, a lot of stigma associated with being a Hibakusha, and it was, you know, really hard for them, apart from being physically often injured and scarred and deeply traumatized psychologically and mentally, you know, having to struggle with survivor guilt, you know, when they were other family members and friends died and it was pure luck that they weren't incinerated as well. All of the things that they had to deal with, difficulties in employment, when people didn't know anything and didn't understand about radiation, you know, the sense that these were contaminated people, that you couldn't go near them, that difficult to find partners and have children because people often didn't want the risk of harm passed on down the generations. They were discriminated against in employment. You know, I've found people, you know, when they open up decades later, like the guy I remember the most was, you know, really tough local Hiroshima politician who'd chaired the city council for quite a while and you know, was a pretty man of the world. He had his feet on the ground. I remember him weeping with me 60 years after the bombings. I was the first person that he actually revealed to that he was a Baksho as well himself. Even decades later, the shame and pain of that carries through with extraordinary pungency. You just can't survive something like, you know, the gates of hell being opened as they were that day and not be deeply affected by it. So not all of them speak publicly, but I think many do, and we should be enormously grateful for their courage to relive those painful stories every time they tell them, and to, you know, to really heed their warning for us, because it resonates down the years at no time, you know, louder and more relevant than today, when nuclear dangers are really all heading in the wrong direction.
Yes, you must be really disappointed after all those years of the work of so many people to try and bring about a change in attitude of governments and business and whoever to stop using or stop producing these nuclear weapons, that there's more and more countries, if they've got them now, and I believe that there are others sort of planning for it. How do you cope with that, knowing all that you know?
It's frustrating. What alternative do you have? You know, it's either the end of nuclear weapons or the end of us. You know, it's that simple, really. We just have to keep going, because hope is not some abstract concept or attitude. It's, you know, hope in action is the only kind of hope that really means anything. And, you know, these are instruments that are not preordained, you know, that are not inevitable because of any law of nature. These are machines that were built by human beings, and we've already made significant progress towards stigmatizing, restricting, eliminating them. There were 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world in 1986. You know, now there's 12,241, but last count. So close to 90% of the nuclear weapons that have ever been built have been dismantled. And some of those have been dismantled on time in a verified way by treaties that have either reduced certain numbers of certain weapons or eliminated whole classes of nuclear weapons. We've seen nuclear testing almost stop. We've seen that nuclear taboo to which the Hibakusha have really contributed, that, you know, these are simply global suicide bombs that can't be used, that mustn't be used, maintained, you know, painfully and with difficulty, despite the many situations where, because of accidents or active deliberations, nuclear weapons were almost used. You know, we're here because of good luck, not because of good management, and sometime that luck's got to run out. So, you know, for everything that you care about and love that's worth doing, there really couldn't be anything better to do any, you know, every day than to work to save the world, and quite literally. And while that's burden that we have at this time, is a rather awesome responsibility, it's also a profound opportunity to do the greatest good for current and future generations that any human beings have ever been able to do. So, you know, this is not stuff you do on your own. It's always lots of people in lots of ways that share this work. So seeing yourself as part of something bigger, I think, helps. And, you know, making sure that you take the issue, but not yourself, too seriously, that you nurture yourself, that you stay grounded. You know, those are the things, I guess, that help me keep going.
And it is a worldwide movement?
Very much so. And that's another one of the sort of joys and wonders of working in this work. And especially now in this era of modern communications, it's actually so much easier than it's ever been to stay in touch with people, to coordinate internationally. And it makes the work so much more interesting and rewarding, but also more effective when you work together. And, you know, this issue is entirely global. If a nuclear war happened anywhere in the world, then people would suffer and be affected. You know, this is something we need to take personally. We're all jeopardized. We're all threatened by these weapons. Whether we have any say or whether we live in countries that would be directly targeted or involved or not. I've often found that, you know, if there's a brick wall particular work in Australia, well, you know, there's always somewhere else to push. You know, probably some of the most useful things I've been involved with have been outside my own country. And that's fine because this is global work. So I think having that sense of, you know, of a citizen of planet Earth and not sort of just being confined to arbitrary national borders in our thinking and our work and our solidarity and our collaborations has certainly been very enriching, but also really important for the work. You know, sometimes the best way to influence one government is by doing things outside that country on the people who can influence it. There's all kinds of ways of working internationally, but it makes the work so much more effective to be coordinated. And in many ways, that was the singular kind of strength of ICANN, that it helped, you know, this campaign coalition idea that was really pioneered in the weapons field, in the landmines, international campaign to ban landmines, which we modelled ICANN on. You know, don't set up a new organisation, but deal as many as possible civil society organisations together to work from the same hymn sheet, you know, to sing in a coordinated way. And trade unions, environment organisations, human rights organisations, churches, you know, all kinds of civil society groups pulling together. And when it came to negotiating in the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, you know, the governments that were leading that said, you know, we can't deal with lots of different civil society players with somewhat competing and different priorities. You know, we need one credible go-to partner when it comes to negotiations. And that was the, you know, the role that ICANN played in the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So in working with governments too, it enormously helps to be coordinated for the left hand to know what the right hand's doing, to much more effective.
Apart from the Nobel Peace Prize for ICANN, there have been a number of awards for you, Tillman, but I'd imagine that you'd say, well, that's part of a collaborative of all the people that I've worked with over the years.
Absolutely. You know, the Nobel Peace Prize was of course the greatest of those joys, and I was so chuffed that that year, the year that the treaty was negotiated and adopted at the UN was in July. You know, in October we were told you've got the Nobel Peace Prize. I was really hopeful that the treaty would be recognised in some way by that global recognition. I didn't really care whether it was Elaine Gomez-White, the extraordinary president of the negotiating conference, or some of the leading nations or their diplomats, Austria, particularly Alexander Kmint, and others, or ICANN or some combination of those, or Hibakusha organisations. I didn't really care. I just thought it was really important for the Nobel Committee to recognise the historic significance of that first treaty that actually bans nuclear weapons by the award of the Nobel Peace Prize in the same year. Of course, I'm doubly delighted that it was awarded to ICANN, but yes, it was awarded to the organisation and not to any individual. And the executive director, Beatrice Finn at the time, and Setsuko Thurlow, Hiroshima survivor, co-accepted that prize for ICANN. And I think that was also an important inclusion, and a younger, active woman and a Hibakusha and two women was, you know, was a pretty deliberate choice. It was very proud of them and of the whole organisation. So this really belongs to everybody who's worked on this issue.
Well, it's 80 years, Tillman, and the work goes on, and I'm sure that you're going to give it your best for as long as you can.
Sure will.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Dr. Tillman Ruff.
3CR, your station, your voice.
These weapons are pointed at all of us. Take it personally.
And we need to be standing with communities on the front lines and really amplifying their fight and their voices.
And fight this until Australia is no longer one of the leading weapons manufacturers.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
Next, a short piece from a longer interview on Talk World Radio featuring activist for peace, anti-war, Kathy Kelly.
The Hague Group called for an emergency summit at The Hague, and 30 countries went. I'm so sorry, in Bogota. 30 countries went. Well, that, you know, is no small thing, but when you go through... And you could just do a quick Google search and you get it, the economic information on each of those countries, with very few exceptions, they're all continuing their economic trade with Israel, with illegal Israeli settlements. The UN International Court of Justice ruling gave September 19th, that's the deadline date. And at that point, the illegal settlement and occupation has to be dismantled. Well, there's no hint of moving in that direction. And according to the International Court of Justice ruling advisory opinion, there should be no military support. Well, even Ireland continues to allow the planes to land at Shannon Airport and bring military supplies and soldiers over to the region, and then they get to Israel. And there's a factory in Israel that's continuing to manufacture parts for weapons. Francesca Albanese's report made it really clear that large conglomerate tech groups like Google and Amazon in the United States are enabling that hideous, pernicious surveillance and tracking. I've been thinking a lot about the White Rose in Germany, too. Young Germans, that incredible bravery. They had to know the risks they were taking, and they'd go out and paint slogans in the middle of the night in Munich, where they were university students, Hans and Sophie Scholl. And they would get together a small group, and they'd mail out flyers and say, distribute these. And they'd make enormous copies and put stacks of flyers in their universities. And at one point, Sophie got extra energetic, and she pushed the stack of flyers off the top ledge of a top floor in the Munich University, and a janitor saw her do it. So all these flyers are fluttering down, accusing the Nazi tyranny and saying, we will not be silent. And then they were arrested, and 4 days later at the guillotine, they were both executed. Israel is executing every single grouping of witnesses. 210 journalists have been executed, and many more maimed and displaced and burned and threatened and harassed. The doctors, whose witness is crucial, are taking their lives in their hands if they just say, look at my destroyed hospital. Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, on his seventh month of being held in solitary confinement, beaten so badly he might lose one eye, lost like 30 pounds. He gets one meal a day, maybe, and sometimes that's just two spoonfuls of rice. But other doctors assassinated, their families wiped out, doctors and nurses, ambulance crews, and one 12-year-old boy, Muhammad Badrwill, witnessed shooting of a large number of ambulance crew rescue workers or vehicles turned up in March of 2025 to try to rescue some other people. And the Israeli forces opened fire on them, shot them in their torsos and heads. And this little boy just witnessed it. And so people were questioning him, trying to investigate. He's standing by the seashore and he was assassinated. How do they track the 12-year-old, the doctors? How do they know when the doctor is not on the shift at the hospital and is at home? It's using the technology that Google and Amazon and Palantir supply. And then they showcase these weapons so that they can sell more. Who is benefiting? Well, the Israeli stock market is over the top. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Electric, General Atomics, RTX. Why end the war? They're making so much money. And then Netanyahu, if he loses, the very, very right-wing extremists in the Knesset, he's out, and then he could trot off to jail, which is... And so there's a lot of invested interest in prolonging a hideous war. And, you know, when you think of people who are, for instance, surgeons and can't stand to do the surgery because they're so weakened, or that four groups with media in Gaza have said, you know, our people can't report, they're too weak to get out and try to cover the story. The starvation was predictable, but it certainly now is happening. It's a charnel house. We're watching on our screens. And yet, you know, I do have to say that around the world, there are large demonstrations, and even now in front of the United Nations, as the United Nations deliberates about a two-state solution, which I believe would be no kind of a solution, there are large numbers of people that are congregating and saying, stop the words, take action. A group went over to the Egyptian consulate last week, and their chant was, starving children cannot wait, open up the Rafah gate. People are on to the corruption. And this idea that you can get Egypt and Qatar and Jordan together and they'll do airdrops, that's the worst possible solution. Some of the pallets fall on people's heads and kill them, and the trucks are backed up. The UN, UNRWA, they know how to do this. The political will that's missing. And you can listen in on all of these UN meetings now. And Mary Robinson, former president of Ireland, one of the co-directors of the elders, she gave a very good speech. And she's saying what's really true, but you can hear it said again and again. They have to stop the trade. They have to stop the shipments. They can suspend Israel from the United Nations. They can shun and scorn Israel. They do it in words, but they can give teeth to it. The Hague Group is a start. But I do want to say, this is no time to give up. Lean in on this issue. I think it's a conundrum because I want to say to the world governments, take action. And I do see an action that I think is viable, but it's experimental. And I guess I have to say to myself, this is no time to be recommending experiments. But the experiment is also flagged by Francesca Albanese. There are unarmed civilian peacemaking groups in Palestine now. They're in the West Bank. And they do have effect. When the settlers come to harass a town that's got internationals living there, and the internationals go out, I think they have a siren on their car or something, the settlers disperse. The Israeli military supports some of these harassing and murderous settlers who steal sheep and set fire to farms. So if the, but this is where I'm I have to say, this may be no time for experiments, but if the United Nations were to say, yes, we're going to send in peacekeeping groups, no tanks, no weapons, and then opened up for civil society to send contingents, if the money was there to facilitate it, I think you'd find many, many, many people willing to go in, take up residence, but they'd have to not drain the area of all of its food and water. But there are groups who have been thinking about this for a long time. And certainly the United Nations could facilitate a massive intervention without weapons if at the same time it was suspending Israel from the United Nations and encouraging absolutely no more weapons. Now, Dr. Feroz Tzidwa, a very eminent surgeon who just got back from Gaza, he says, look, you know, there's only one thing that needs to happen. Trump picks up the phone and says, we're done, no more weapons. So there's the conundrum. Do we try to experiment with something massive and new at a time when people are already falling down on the streets out of starvation? Do we just lean in on Trump and think that he's the magic solution? Try to hope the United Nations could make a difference. But, you know, we should certainly remind people that Edward Horgan was an Irish militarist, really, and he had a very big conversion, and he was a part of a number of those unarmed civilian protection forces. And then he's on the board for World Beyond War, and also Dr. John Ruhr has certainly tried his best to create a group that would go to Zaporizhia. So it has been thought about, it has been explored.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
The Victorian State Government is planning repressive new laws to restrict protest, including bans on protective masks and lock-on devices, increased police search powers, restrictions on symbols of resistance such as flags, and creation of so-called safe zones around religious buildings, putting significant areas of the CBD off limits. We must say no to this attack on democracy. Protest is a fundamental human right. Join the fight to defend it at a mass rally hosted by Defend Dissent Coalition on Tuesday, 12th of August, 5:30 p.m. at Parliament House. Defend Dissent Coalition is a 3CR supporter.
The principal barrier to a rapid energy transition is the title of an article in Pearls and Irritations. The author is Dr. Mark Diesendorf. Dr. Diesendorf was originally a physicist who expanded into interdisciplinary research on energy and sustainability. Previously, he was Professor of Environmental Science and Founding Director of the Institute for Sustainable Futures, the University of Technology, Sydney. Currently, he is Honorary Associate Professor in the Environment and Society Group in the School of Humanities and Languages, UNSW, Sydney. We hear now part two of the interview I recorded with Mark. Mark, you're talking about a time when neoliberalism is pretty well entrenched in many countries, including Australia. What's that barrier?
Yeah, well, neoliberalism is an economic ideology which basically says governments should be small, they should collect little tax, and they should leave most of the major social and political decisions to the market. But this is just another way of saying, let's leave all the big decisions to the 1% of people who actually control the market. It's not a free market. It's controlled. It's dominated by very powerful vested interests. Now, fortunately, neoliberalism has failed again and again, and increasingly, people are beginning to recognize it. So, for example, during the global financial crisis in 2008, governments could not follow neoliberal policies of not making high government spending. In fact, they ignored neoliberalism and they spent enormously in Australia and around the world in order to keep the economies going. And during the COVID pandemic, the same thing happened. Our government spent hundreds of billions of dollars, that's billions with a B, to keep the economy going and to help, to some extent, to help the disadvantaged, although many of the large corporations got most of the benefit. So neoliberalism failed on both those and on other occasions. And gradually, the awareness is that we have to throw it out. It's a political ideology. It's based on very shaky economics. Neoclassical economics, so-called, is very shaky in terms of most absurd assumptions. But neoliberalism is, and along with capitalism generally, is responsible for fueling the idea that we have to have endless growth on a finite planet, which is absolutely unsustainable, absolutely ridiculous. And they also fuel the notion that wealth trickles down from the rich to the poor. But there have been a number of studies that actually disprove this in many of the richest countries of the world. It doesn't work that way. And yet right now we see our government and other governments are giving enormous tax benefits to the large corporations and to the very rich. Neoliberalism has to go, and increasingly there are more and more voices criticizing neoliberalism and the current economic system, which is not concerned primarily about ecological sustainability or social justice. These are minor considerations in the conventional economic system, and they have to become the prime goals of a decent economic system.
I believe, I might be wrong, but I believe that you're speaking mainly about wealthier countries. But what about the countries of the South, including China and India, where the vast majority of the population of the world lives? How is this change going to affect them?
Yeah, that's a very important question. Thanks for that. Yes, the first thing to say is really that because most of the environmental impacts come from the rich countries and from rich people, that we're the ones who have to reduce our consumption and redistribute it better through universal public services and a job guarantee. And we have to do that also to leave space for the poorer countries to develop, but to develop with financial support from the rich countries so that they don't make the same mistakes that we did. You mentioned China. Well, China is a very interesting example because China, and nowadays, despite being the world leader in greenhouse gas emissions, is also the world leader in wind power, in the manufacture and sale of wind turbines. It's the world leader in the manufacture and use of solar modules. It's the world leader in solar hot water. It is reaching the stage now where it's leveling off its greenhouse gas emissions ahead of its scheduled program. So there's a lot of hope with China. And I would also say that we can't really consider China as a poor country anymore. Mm. It has a massive middle class now. Although it's no longer, in my view, a communist country, it's a state capitalist country, there's still considerable poverty in China, but a lot of that has moved into a middle class. With the really poor countries, I mean, their main problem is that they are poor because they have been exploited through colonialism and nowadays through neo-colonialism. And we can still see that, the huge control that countries like the United States, for example, have on trade, so that the poorer countries have always had difficulty in selling their goods to the richer countries at a decent price and getting a good deal. The difference under Trump is that he's totally open about neocolonialism. He wants to rule everything, and he certainly doesn't want to see the poorer countries getting together, trading amongst themselves and creating their own standard currency and so on. Yes, I mean, the poorer countries need to develop, but they need to develop in a way that they don't add to the environmental destruction on this planet. And that means that we in the richer countries have the responsibility of working with the Global South, financing the developments of the Global South. And again, China is doing that on quite a large scale. Of course, they have their own strategic reasons for doing that. They're not just doing it out, perhaps out of the goodness of their heart, but they're doing it at the same time as the US is retreating, closing down its US aid and so on.
One other thing I meant to mention was the fact that countries, they promote their growth of the year and they say it's a great thing, and if you've gone from 5% down to 4% a year, it's a bad thing. How are you going to stop that between nations? Because you know, that is just fueling the issue we've been talking about.
Absolutely. And this is one of the hardest things. It's hard enough within a nation to change the propaganda and the culture that says that economic growth is a measure of human well-being, or even though it is not. To get an international agreement, particularly at the current time, when we have international agreements being broken time and again by the United States, absolutely destroying the so-called rules of engagement between countries, it becomes exceedingly difficult. But on the other hand, we are seeing a growth of other countries, the less rich countries, the BRICS countries, which originally BRICS, I think, stood for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, but it's now greatly expanded to many other countries. And they are starting to try to operate independently of the power of the United States Empire. So that's one hope, but it's a difficult one. I mean, even in BRICS, you have Russia, which has no commitment to reducing climate change at all. The only hope there is that China, which really does have major climate action, climate mitigation programs, the hope is that China will be able to influence Russia eventually in some way to bring its emissions and emission exports under control. But then talking about emission exports, of course, Australia is one of the biggest exporters of fossil fuels in the world. The Australian government seems to be too closely captured by the fossil fuel industry, and it keeps supporting the expansion of exports of fossil fuels to the rest of the world. And wherever those fuels are burnt, they add to global climate change.
Well, you've only got to look at the results of all this around the world weekly, daily, of disasters, whether it's flooding, earthquakes, tornadoes, whatever. Are there researchers and scholars and public officials ready and willing to take on the task of educating? Because that's what it's needed, isn't it, too, an education program so that people can understand what is happening and what the results will be and what they should be doing.
Yes, education is very important, but that's been going on for decades, and we still have governments half-hearted, like the Australian government, whichever party is in power, at very least to say they're half-hearted about dealing effectively with climate change. I believe that the problem, the fundamental problem underlying all of this, is the political power of vested interests, very powerful industries like the fossil fuel industry. And this isn't just in relation to climate change. It's, one can argue that our governments, whichever government is in power, and the public service, have been to a large degree captured by very powerful vested interests, such as the fossil fuel industry, the property industry, the financial services industry, the gambling industry. All these industries are ensuring that they get what they want at the expense of the public at large. And so my argument, and the argument in my latest book, The Path to a Sustainable Civilization, is that in fact the community organizations, the non-government organizations, have to form alliances to put a very, very strong pressure on governments in Australia to weaken the power of these vested interests, to weaken state capture, which is going on at present, whether it's in gambling or property developments or greenhouse gas emissions. The beauty of that is that it would be the interests of the community at large and all the non-government organisations to tackle some of the methods used by these very powerful vested interests to become powerful and to get the policies they want. And these methods include, of course, political donations and election expenditure, revolving door jobs between retiring ministers and the vested interests. So we have a situation in Australia where retiring ministers of resources and then or energy of both major political parties have, upon retirement, moved almost immediately into much higher paid jobs in the industries for which they were responsible as ministers. And we also have the revolving door turning in the opposite direction, where political advisors to ministers are appointed from vested interests like the Minerals Council of Australia. These things have to be exposed and challenged. We've seen scandals about lobbying and consulting in this country. They have to be addressed. So my argument is that it is now necessary, overdue, to form alliances between community non-government organisations in a wide range of fields to combat the methods of state capture that I've just mentioned. And of course, media, the media ownership laws. We used to have media ownership laws, but now we have a mass media of which the vast majority is controlled by one corporation, News Corp. So all these things have to be open to public scrutiny, to the democratic process, and challenged. And we need a very strong public voice to reduce the state capture, the anti-democratic situation where much of our government policies are determined by powerful vested interests.
Well, just finally, Mark, it's a big task, but we can't wait too long, can we?
Well, in terms of climate change, we're really running out of time. And I have to say also in terms of the threat of nuclear war, that we're in a situation in Australia now where many governments have just tied themselves excessively to the whims of the United States, which has dragged us into fruitless wars, pointless wars, which have been very destructive, whether it's in Vietnam or Afghanistan or Syria or Iraq. We are now in a situation where we could be dragged into a war between the United States and China. And if that happens, one of the first things China would do, would have to do, would be to take out the US bases in Australia. And one of those bases is effectively in Perth. We really have to rethink our relations with the United States. And I think the Trump presidency has really underlined this need and rethink the very foolish AUKUS agreement, which involves us spending hundreds of billions of dollars on a technology that may never occur. And if it does, will be out of date because nuclear-powered submarines will be easily wiped out by drones. There you have it. Very powerful vested interests have to be combated, and they are active in Australia. Before the AUKUS agreement, there was a handful of retired US admirals employed by the Australian Department of Defence to advise it on future acquisitions of weapons. So the whole thing is corrupt, and it's based on capturing the nation state, government opposition, public service, media, and so on. And it has to be exposed, it has to be challenged, it has to be fought in the interests of democratic, genuine democratic decision making.
I thank you for today and look forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure, Jan.
I've been speaking to Dr. Mark Dusendorf. He's currently Honorary Associate Professor in the Environment and Society Group in the School of Humanities and Languages at UNSW in Sydney. He is the lead author of The Path to a Sustainable Civilization, Technological, Socio-Economic and Political Change, Palgrave Macmillan, 2023.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.